Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to Blog Talk Radio and the Voice of Change. I am Sharon Ann Wyckoff and delighted to be with you for another program. Today, it is my delight to be with Donna Runnels. Donna is by profession, is a licensed psychotherapist and an enthusiastic certified teacher of Qigong, Qigong, an energy cultivation practice from China. Today, she is with us as the executive director of Living Bridges Foundation. Donna founded Living Bridges, a 501c3 foundation, in 1995. For the last 16 years, Living Bridges Foundation has adopted and supported projects in Peru and Ecuador, initiated by indigenous communities or individuals to help build and maintain sustainable lifestyles within their environmental and economic reality. Donna emphasized to me as we were talking that she is always invited in by the native people for collaboration in these projects. So we are going to have a 1 to 2 hour discussion with Donna about all the projects that she's doing and how she is presently leaving tomorrow for the South Americas and to continue her work down there. So do stay tuned for a wonderful two-hour show. The Voice of Change brings to internet radio individuals speaking out on pertinent aspects of life during these very transformational times. During these programs, I interview spiritual leaders, enlightened teachers, educational professionals, visionaries, educators, birth therapists, cultural creatives, and artists. Guests share their perspective, their expertise, and insights to support, encourage, and inspire new ways for these very changing times. These times, I believe, are asking us to live in greater harmony with ourselves, our loved ones, as well as with all on the planet. No longer can we live unconsciously. The time for conscious creating has come. And although there is much chaos taking place on the planet and in the lives of many, the potential for greater understanding, healing, and change has never been greater. This is the time to be open to new ideas, new possibilities, and new ways of handling old problems. Individuals as well as numerous groups are working diligently to bring about change on the planet. The journey into the new world begins with just one new idea and one small step. Let's begin anew in each and every moment. I'd like to tell you a little bit more about the work that Donna is doing. As I said, she founded Living Bridges in 1995 and has been working with indigenous communities since that time. The current project of Living Bridges, initiated by a native Ecuadorian from the village of Agua Santa, Ecuador, is to support their long-term project of reforesting an entire deforested mountain area involving 23 highland communities. As I read this, I'm just, you know, amazed at the work she's doing. In addition, Dawn is going to share about the importance of reforestation worldwide. She's also going to talk about her awakening to the plight of the rainforests of the South Americas when in 1989 she visited the Yucatan and witnessed the burning of the last forest. This experience led her to her personal action on behalf of the forests in the South Americas. So it is with great pleasure that I welcome Donna Runnels to the program. Welcome, Donna.
Thank you so much, Sharon. And I really loved your introduction, hearing about your work, and just to have this opportunity to meet, to be among the voices of change along with you and I'm sure any listeners out there, so thank you.
Yes. Oh, you're so welcome. It's just a delight to have you on, and I'm just so amazed by all the work that you are doing, and I'm just so excited to have these, you know, 2 hours if we need it, to really talk about all that you've done and the journey that you have been on as an activist and the director of Living Bridges over the last, 20 years. So, you know, to begin with, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? And I know your family has a rich background. and how you began all this work, what led you into doing the work in the South Americas.
Thank you, Sharon. I want to add a note of an additional note of gratitude just to say that I have given talks and presented a lot of the material that I hope to share with the listeners and you today in the past, but I've never had a chance to put it together a little bit with my personal history. And I wanted to say that as a psychotherapist, I know from my 30 years of being a therapist that the healing value of having your story listened to and having your work and yourself reflected. And so in that, just to say that I want to dedicate also what I'm going to say to all the many people who have supported me in this work and the amazing synchronicities that involve all those people and communities and also the earth. So I would like to be a voice of change, a voice also for the earth today as I answer that question.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yes, of course. Oh, it's just an honor to have you. So that's a beautiful dedication.
Thank you, Sharon. So I was telling you a little bit about this, and I'll tell the listeners that
please,
as they look back, I believe that all of us have a kind of personal mythology, or as we look at our life, it could be a timeline history, but it could also be look at the things that shape us in our life when we see how our life unfolded from a certain vantage point.
Yeah.
So I looked back over that just to see and to be able to share a little bit about the roots of my interest in this work that I'm doing and have been doing. And as a child, I was born in Philadelphia, and as a child very young, my father was very ill, and he had a mastoid condition in his ear, and that could no longer be healed by any antibiotic. He had become resistant. So the doctors at that time prescribed a common treatment for this kind of condition in those days, which was to go to the desert. And in the early 1950s, that was quite a proposal for my very young parents in their 20s to take their children all the way out from Philadelphia to the desert. But not only that, for especially on my father's side, and this is what I was going to share a little more about, the that side of the family, my name on that side is Remy, and the Remys had come as French Huguenots fleeing the persecution that was taking place in Europe at that time. They came in the late 1600s to New York, and they were potters, and they settled on a place called Potter's Hill. And later they immigrated in the early 1700s to Philadelphia and started their pottery factory right on the Delaware River. So for all those hundreds of years, up until we left in the 50s and even beyond that, my father's family had lived in Philadelphia, so there were many, many people, cousins, uncles, and they were very well networked into that city. My mother's family were Irish, and of course they came over in the potato famine, and then also from Germany, from Baden-Baden, because in Germany in the 1850s there was also a difficult time with famine. So my grandfather, before he died, always remarked that he lived and he died within six blocks of where he was born.
Oh, my goodness.
There was a long history in that city.
Mm-hmm.
So we came all the way out to the middle of the desert. We lived in an old gatehouse in the Phoenix area, out right in the middle of the desert. It was an old gatehouse for a pomegranate ranch. And my parents thought that they'd be able to return if my father's health was restored, but that never happened. So there we were, and my mother also became ill over those next 2 years. So during that time,
That would be a challenging time for you. How old were you at this time now, Donna?
I was, well, during that time, it was up until the age of four that we were there.
Oh, my. Wow.
And so during that time, I think both wandering in the desert and having that time with the earth, and also because in Arizona, as we know, there were many reservations at the time. In the 1950s, there was much more displacement of all the different tribes, and there were many Yaqui and Mescalero Apache that would wander along the side of the roads with their children and wearing their blankets. And this was always quite a mystery to me because we never had any contact with them, and I always had such a curiosity about who they were and how they lived.
Oh, how interesting.
It was a very interesting time.
So reflect back and see the work that you're doing today. I can see the connections of how they're developing.
Thank you, Sharon. That really was a root. So the other part is that even though we could say that we're all immigrants in one way or another somehow with our roots, that I think it shaped the sense as I went on and grew of having lost a connection to my family, to the large, large family that we had there, and of hoping to restore some kind of roots that I felt I was missing. So this took me into the 60s, along with many, many other people, when we were experiencing also the American Indian Movement. And for myself in California at the time, I also had the opportunity to study about the California Indians and learning that there were over 300 tribes just in this area with separate systems and languages was just an amazing discovery for me and propelled me more into studying with Native teachers. I studied North American shamanism, Sweat Lodge, vision questing. For many years, I had teachers. And again, all of this shaped my interest in this area.
Oh, of course.
So this overlaps a little bit. I don't know if I could begin and just tell you a little bit how this merged into Living Bridges.
Okay, sure. Yes, please do that.
So I continued to live in California during those years, and in 1989, one day I went to my post office box here in Aptos where I live, and there was a tiny little card in the 3x5 card in the post office box, and it was entitled Journey to La Selva. And as I read it, I noticed that an anthropologist whom I was very familiar with, Joan Halifax, who wrote one of the earlier studies from a North American person of European descent called Shamanic Voices. She had studied with many medicine teachers and also was Joseph Campbell's assistant in the early days.
Oh, my. Uh-huh.
She was offering a journey down into the Yucatan area, and we were to visit the Lacandon Maya people. They were described in this little postcard as the last real living descendants of the original Maya.
Oh, my.
So when I read this, for some reason, I just knew I had to go.
Mm.
And even though, as I look back now, and I had investigated the history of the actual demise of the rainforest as they were, this began much, much earlier than it came to my attention.
Uh-huh.
1989 was the first time I became aware of the condition of the forest and the whole network of things that were happening with the forests of the Southern Americas.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I went on this journey with Joan, and we went to see the Lacandon Maya, which was a journey in itself. And this came into a second journey with her, which was even more important, because on that one, it was just before what was later called the War in Chiapas. It was a little later, a couple years later, that we went back again. And at that time, we walked altogether 40 miles through the rainforest.
Oh, you did?
It was quite amazing. And in that time, not only did we wander, sort of speechless, I know I was, through this primary forest, but also came upon areas, both in our car travel to get to the trailheads, and in other parts of our journey, to the places where the rainforest was burning.
Mm.
And seeing the contrast.
You know, before you keep going, can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to walk through that forest so that we have a sensory experience? I don't know if you can take a few minutes to tell us the good parts and then the bad parts.
This is a really fun question. Thank you for that, because one of the images, of course, that comes to my mind in the primary forest, many people, well, I'm sure some listeners have been to a primary rainforest. In those forests, just like our primary forests and, the, say, the redwood forests of Washington and so forth, there's a large canopy overhead, and actually the fourth floor is quite clear. So in those times as we walked, we could view the beautiful morpho, the blue butterflies. People have seen them or seen them in photographs. As the cathedral light came through the rainforest trees down to the floor. And also we were showered with flowers, flower petals. And one of
you
those
were,
flowers...
because the flowers were just falling?
One of the flowers I remember so well, because as I became aware that the mahogany cult, which was... Mahogany was such a popular wood in the 30s and 40s and even the 50s here. These mahogany trees, these great trees, had great roots, just like redwoods that connected to other trees. So as they came down, they pulled with them a large portion of forest. I was able to see the mahogany flowers as well, and they were gorgeous white flowers. And the seed pods of those flowers, as they opened up, turned into four beautiful spoon-like utensils, which... The native people
for
spoons.
Spoons.
So that was
my.
Part of the imagery. As we got closer to the deforested areas where we were in secondary forest, the Rambo movies were popular at that time, and the green mud, because they were actually filmed in the Yucatan, the sliding through the green mud was one of the things I recall trying to get through the forest. And also with the density of this secondary growth, we were actually following the Lacandones who came to meet us and take us as their guides back to the village. So oftentimes they would disappear as our group threaded out through the rainforest, and you would literally have to run to try to keep up with them through the mud. So the rainforest is like a community of biodiversity that is almost too much to take in as you walk through it. It's constantly moving, constantly growing, and constantly alive. That's a little bit of the imagery.
Oh, that's just so beautiful. I just had a little experience going out to Armstrong Forest, Armstrong Woods in Guerneville. So I've seen that canopy, and it just can be gorgeous, but you've added such strong images here. It must have been just gorgeous when it was the true forest.
It was very beautiful, Sharon, and there's so many stories from this journey, including the fact that we were accompanied by officials from the Mexican government on this trip, because at that time, as listeners may know, the War of the Americas was going on in Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, or had gone on, and there were many displaced people that had fled north from their countries into this Yucatan area, and the government was very concerned about the overpopulation. I don't know if they needed to be concerned that way, but they went to see how this was impacting the forest. We also became aware of that displacement and had meetings with those people and with the people of that area. And so it was quite a rich cross-culture experience at the same time.
Yes.
I want to add a note about the Lacandon Maya, just so this ties in with the roots that I was talking about that we all feel, both uncovering for some of us the roots of our own past, maybe our ancestry in a different country, but just also the loss of some of these great traditions. So it does turn out that the Lacandon Maya do speak a type of Mayan language that has been studied as very related to the Mayan language of the Palenque ruins. And that's a whole other story for people who know about Palenque. They know that the temples there overlap the last great emperor of that area, and also his son, who became more of a warrior king as the Mayan culture fell from its original high stature. So the Lacandones lived only in two villages, and their teacher, who was known as Chan Kin Viejo, he was very old at the time already, was really the main keeper of the traditional knowledge. And the people already, having been exposed to Western ways were not so interested in keeping their culture. But also the elders, including Chankin Biehl, was not so interested in passing along all of his original knowledge to students, which often happens because teachers don't find the proper student who they feel.
Yes, I've heard about that.
Yes, it's very common. So it was Joan Halifax actually wrote a beautiful book, and this journey, one of our journeys, is detailed in her book called The Fruitful Darkness, which some of the listeners might be interested in. She later founded a Buddhist center, which still exists in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and she's a Buddhist teacher. So so I had a chance to understand better about this situation also with the Native Americans of the Southern Americas. And we met a woman by the name of Trudy Bloom, and listeners could actually research her on the web. She was a Swiss woman who came in the 30s to the Yucatan, and she was trying to support the last forest of the Yucatan. And when we came, we met with her in her home. She was in her 90s then, called House of the Jaguar, Nabalom. And as she, at dinner that evening, she was dressed very elegantly, as she might have been as a European, as we sat in her dining room. And she pounded her fist on the table somewhat in desperation, saying, "The selva," as she spoke in Spanish, "the selva is gone. It's gone. The jungle, the forest is gone." So as she had known it, it was gone.
Yes.
So approximately one-third of the original forest is left now in the Yucatan. It's not all gone. And I haven't studied myself the reserves that are present there, but that's pretty much, you know, where we are. Chankin Viejo died in 1996, and the Lacandones, you know, have not necessarily continued on in those two villages in the same way. So there's much to learn, you know, for all of us.
Oh, yes.
So, Sharon, I would just tell you my personal journey when I came home. I was struck, as some people are, to write poetry, to try to come to terms with what I saw, which is also, you know, the imagery that we find in ourselves, the parts of us that are not honored, the same imagery that's on the earth. You know, how do we bring forth the voices in ourselves and in the earth that aren't being heard? So I began going into the schools and taking my slides from this trip and from of the original rainforest to the children and giving them.
Oh, how beautiful.
And it was beautiful. And I did learn something. I think we all, as parents, and everyone knows this of children, that they're so open and so wide open, and their love and their hearts are so big. And they took this up right away and loved the forest and wanted to make some changes. The harder thing, of course, was involving the parents. So I could see that right away. And how to support this, I thought, well, perhaps I should take my daughter, who is then, as this went along the next several years, 12 years old, perhaps we should go together down to the forest so she can see it herself. So that
what
was
a beautiful experience. Oh, hard but beautiful.
It was, Sharon. So of course Jane was delighted, and we went the summer of her 12th year down on a teacher's trip. So I thought it could be pretty tame with all these wonderful school teachers going on this journey to Ecuador. And it was there that I first journeyed to the Napo Basin of Ecuador, which is, Napo River is one of the tributaries of the Amazon, and the provincial capital of Ecuador, Tena, is in that area. The capital, of course, in the Andes is Quito. So Jane and I spent 2 weeks in a place called Hatun Sacha, which means great forest in Quechua. Quechua is the native language that's spoken through much of the Andes still, and it is from, you know, the Inca times. So Michael McComb is a person worth mentioning, a wonderful man who came to be my friend at the time, had gone down, same thing. He was struck by the plight of the rainforest in that area because it, at the time, much oil exploration, people know this, had gone on in the Ecuadorian basin. So there's a lot of devastation and pollution. So he decided, he even had to get a PhD in order to do this. He decided to start helping. He came from California to preserve the rainforest there. And along with a man, his name was David, from the Missouri Botanical Gardens, they together started educating about this area and about the species that exist in the special primary forest there. I won't have time to tell you all about it. They started the first preserves down there. So then I had some sense of what maybe the overlap of people from, you know, maybe the Northern Americas and the Southern Americas working together, and more an idea of what could be done through Michael's work.
Mm.
And when Jane and I came home, we started a rainforest group for her friends.
Oh,
and
my.
We got together in the early stages of an online network called Global Action Network, which has done major work over the last 20 years, but it was very new then. And we started letter-writing campaigns with them. One of our projects was to help save the last 3% it was then of rainforest on the northern coast of Ecuador, helping with one of the then presidents of Ecuador turned it into a reserve. And that was one of Michael's projects also, and there is now his reserve called Bilsa Reserve there. And all of these things were collectives also with the native people. It wasn't just, run. It was all a collaboration.
Yes, that's what you said. You know, you always worked with the native people. That's just, you know, a beautiful way to do that.
It's a real topic in itself because people we can wonder about it, and I'm kind of sidestepping that for the moment. But in any case, these children, some people know about the rainforest activist John Seed. He was one of the original rainforest activists in Australia. And Joanna Macy, people know her as a Buddhist teacher. She's a very popular and wonderful Buddhist teacher who teaches here sometimes at Spirit Rock and lives in Berkeley area. She co-authored a book with John called Thinking Like a Mountain. And together they started something called the Council of All Beings, which they took to adult groups and children's groups. And so our group raised money to give a live radio interview show, just like you're doing with John in the Bay Area. And the children got on the radio with him and, got a chance to interact with him and hear about how he, how he envisioned the future even then. And he, at the time, had just made an interview, then it would be a VCR production with Ram Dass. And he excitedly on this talked about his vision, which is to wake up one day different, that one day the human race, you know, as the 100th monkey says, we will wake up one day different.
Mm.
So he was a big influence then in the work as one of many who was doing this work, and I began to do Council of All Beings in the school. And that is where the children make a mask, and then in a large council circle, they become the animal or place on the earth of the mask that they drew, and as they go into the center of the circle, they speak for that place on the earth, the voice that hadn't been heard.
Oh, what a wonderful experience.
It truly was, Jaren. You interrupt me, but the story will get a little shorter. This one last piece, because it did involve Jane. It was a wonderful project. Jane got so enthusiastic about all this that she decided that now we needed to take a whole group of young people down there.
Oh, my.
As we called it then. For our purposes. So she actually put on a slideshow herself. And I might note that Jane later majored in acting, but she was very dramatic, and, of course, she was very heartful. She, on this occasion where we invited the parents and the children, age 11 to 14, to her production to talk about the journey that we had planned, at the end of that time there was a clipboard, and I was actually almost horrified to find out how many of these parents were signing up their children to go, I was horrified in the sense that I was quite sure they might not know what they were getting into.
Yes.
I was right, because later many of these same parents decided that they needed to go along too.
Just amazing.
We had what we called a cross-cultural year where we studied every month. Our group got together and with the parents to prepare ourselves for crossing over the threshold into this world. And fortunately for us, a man who is, of course, still living, Bo Boudar, who had won an Emmy nomination for his work with the Valdez disaster. His daughter, Noella, was one of the children in my group. And so Bo decided he would make a film, a professional film of this whole journey, and began filming during that year. So we called it The Children of the Rainforest to signify joining the North and the South. And
that is so special.
I can't tell you all those stories, but we did go and made the film. It was a most amazing journey, and that was my first time also of going into communities, because that's what these children did. We went out and lived in a community in the Napo Basin called Rio Blanco, and it was my first opportunity to meet, they are not called shamans in this area, but the medicine person of each community is often a community leader. And that was the first time that I was able to interview one of these people to hear their voice about the forest.
Oh, my.
And
my.
If we have time today, I want to tell you a little bit about the voices that...
Oh, please do. Do you want to do one of them right now as you're talking about this?
Well, as maybe on the theme of how deeply things touched me on many levels, I remember the morning we got up at sunrise to meet with this man. Alejandro was his name. And as the sun was rising and Bo was filming and I was asking him the few questions I had prepared, we got through talking about his community and what his hopes for the community were. The hopes are just the same as for every father and family man and community man everywhere around the world, which is education for the children and also the preservation of values. And so even as a young man, he spoke to this. And then many of these people, because they work with the visionary plants, and they're also very open to energy messages and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
That morning, as he answered my question, what do you see in the future for the forest? This man, just in brief, said to me, and he was stifling the tears, which also, for all three of us, brought tears to our eyes because of the depth of his heart, as he said,
yes.
When I see the future of the forest, there are so many tears I cry, it turns me into a skeleton.
Oh, my.
And so
goodness.
He couldn't say more, but I think we all knew that he was holding also the burden of the all the many influences that were coming to play in all the forests as they are the forests of the world.
He knew what was happening.
He knew what was happening. He knew what his community would face. And, you know, maybe I would say this, Sharon, in all dignity and respect, to say that as our, you know, first world, developed world, whatever you want to call it, values have over many decades, but certainly the last two have translated and, you know, with the advent of email and all of the things, the computer technology, the people even in the forest, have been exposed to all the values that we have lived in. And as these things come about, because part of them are linked to the things that they want for their children, of course. People want the things that supposedly we have. And at the same time, it's a very complicated subject because the governments of many countries, because of the practices of the World Bank, just for one, the countries who took out loans to create projects, dams, and other things became in debt and had to continue to sell more of their resources in order to hope to get out of debt, which never ended.
Oh, this is very important. So the villages themselves and the people would go into debt to try and save their village?
Well, the actual government of the country.
The government. Okay, the government.
Yes, they would. And so what happens then is as the oil is sold out for the concessions to mainly help the developed world, then the companies would come in and they would offer people things like some money to work for them. And then laws would change because, of course, many of the people are colonists. They have just come to sit on the land. They have fled to try to find a sustainable lifestyle. And many of the laws in Ecuador, for instance, support mining and oil exploration. So at any moment, the government could come in and say, now you have to leave.
So this is
a story we can talk about very briefly when we get to when we get to Patricio's work.
Mm-hmm.
So in any case, I just want to reflect that these values that cross over to the other people wanting a sustainable lifestyle. The young people look to the future. So as they go to the cities and leave the forest, they know we're missing a generation that held, in many cases, the values of the sustainable lifestyle. Not always.
Yes.
There are always
yes.
some in every group, everywhere, that hold those values. But many, many influences and need come to play. So it's not a matter ever of not honoring that this is a dialogue of what people wish. But the forces that displace people from the forest that are out of their hands are way bigger than we can even imagine and are certainly
mm-hmm.
driven by the corporate values that we
yeah.
have. I
yeah.
think we all know that. So that was my first hand as we rowed on the bamboo boats that they had constructed, two girls to a boat down these rivers. We had some hair-raising experiences. On one night in a river, in the large river, the boat almost kept, going over.
Oh, no.
Children, many, many things, the bus breaking, the bridge breaking as we went over a bridge.
No.
Children cheering and the parents screaming.
Oh, my.
And so we had many experiences in that journey. But as we returned, they continued, the children continued in their activism, and some of them... We had a reunion of this group just two summers ago called by one of the girls, Noella, actually, Noella, whose father is the filmmaker. And
right, yes.
To find out what each of these girls had done and how they felt that journey had shaped them. Noella had
what a beautiful
experience.
Yeah,
it was
wouldn't it be wonderful to have them on the air one day to share
that?
That
would be wonderful.
Oh, that would be fabulous.
Noella works as a journalist on a new magazine called Good, and she works alongside of one of Al Gore's sons on that magazine to put out some of the voices of change and, threading this into the next generation. And one of the other young girls, and I observed this about her, she's a very special young girl. She was one of the youngest, 11. Her name is Nicole, and her mom mm-hmm. owns a business here in Aptos. She was inspired to go into the Peace Corps and did two terms over in the Swaziland's AIDS communities. And she was noticeably observed in these trips with many little girls holding her hand and holding her clothes. So there was shades of this as I remember her.
Oh, yes.
So that's just two of the things that were there. Part of the early days in Ecuador, and I don't know, Sharon, I see our time, and I can tell you about Peru in the next section, which
perfect.
Would go into Living Bridges, if that's okay with you.
Of course. Yeah.
Okay. So another synchronicity, one day as I sat with some of my clients who knew that I had done work in the Americas, and one of my clients, whose husband was at the time, her husband then at the time was Peruvian, she told me that you must go to hear this man. I hear there's a medicine person coming directly from Peru. He's never been here, and he's to be speaking this Friday evening at our local in Santa Cruz Pacific Cultural Center. And she said, you just must go. So I immediately decided I would go, and there on that evening I met Don Alejandro Dariki King Waranchi. And Dariki King had just arrived. He was then in his 50s, had just arrived, his first stop, San Francisco, and had come for his first talk to Santa Cruz because friends had invited him here. He had never been out of his country. Never
where
really.
Was he was from Peru?
Pardon me, Sharon?
He was from Peru?
Yes, from Peru, from the Manu region. Dariki King was the seventh chief, he's no longer living, was the seventh chief, every seventh generation in their of the Huachipayrees in the Manu Basin. The Huachipayrees had a special legend that every seventh chief was a great soul. And so Dariki King was the seventh and now the last chief of this endangered group, the Huachipayrees. And so he was truly an amazing man of great heart, and his joy was palpable. That his eyes, his delight, his joy, his message to us of the forest, of the love that comes from the earth. And he touched everyone so deeply. And he told us about his vision. I'm not going to tell you this legend, but he told us about his vision that he would build a center that's very cross-cultural. And he wanted to build a center in the Manu where in the year 2000, this was 1994, it would be a healing center where representatives from all cultures could come to share their different ways of healing and begin this time on the earth where all traditions would come back together. And his vision was called Wanami. So he said he didn't have any money, and he had come there on this journey. I later received a copy of this letter. On this journey, 3 months later, Alejandro, just in his journey around the United States, he was invited, this is how powerful his speaking was, to speak at in the White House before the Department.
Oh, my.
The Department of the Interior. And in the letter, it says, in their thank you, they note that his words had moved them far beyond the cares of the day as of the earth. So for the next year, I was sort of a longtime yoga practitioner. As I said, I'd studied many traditions. So I decided to offer a little yoga group in which I would charge $5 a week for my friends to lead the group, and we would save all of this for Alejandro.
Oh.
So by the end of the year, I had raised around $1,000. And I had a contact address for Alejandro in Cusco. And I, through that person, I was able to send this money to Alejandro to start his center. And
Donna, that's so sweet.
And so I didn't know. I was hoping he would get it. I was so moved by, of course I said that, but I was so moved by him that he would get this opportunity. So about a month later, I got a handwritten letter from Alejandro, and he invited me to come down. And stay there. So so that was my first trip down to Peru. And there are just so many stories. To his region, which was amazing. To meet his family. There were several others with us. And Alejandro, many people in this area know about the plant medicines. Alejandro was later I learned just what a high level he was. He was a very high teacher of the ayahuasca tradition, the ayahuasca plant, and many other healing plants. But in order for this ceremony to be done, for Alejandro, you had to prepare for at least 2 months to do the ceremony. I won't detail all this, but one of the things I learned and had a firsthand experience of for in doing some of this work, just really only very few experiences, but they had a profound effect on me because Alejandro told us the energy of the earth is amor puro, pure love. And when I was in these experiences and throughout my time with him, that was the experience I had, that the earth wants us to know her love for us. And be able to return to that beautiful love.
Yes.
So through a series of events, I got to know the director who became the director of Pro Naturaleza, a NGO organization in Peru doing environmental work. And Modesto Chalco became the director of Manu Park, the biggest sequestered area of rainforest in that area, which of course still exists, and he happened to be the godfather of Alejandro's son. So Modesto and I got to know each other, and Alejandro at that time asked me to be the godmother of his center. And
how special.
There are so many stories. We had quite a ceremony for that and involving the whole community and many, many things. So this is a whole story in itself. That was a link. I want to tell you about the next project in Peru, but needless to say, what happened through that, Alejandro was able to become also an NGO, a nonprofit in his country, forming his board with his son, Joel, who still runs Centro Wanami. We were able to receive the vision of Alejandro's channeling of the original, you know, the channel he got from the universe of the architecture that the center would be built based on the elements of the earth, all that same cross-culturally, the five elements, and how this would all be designed, and all the basics of the center and the beginnings of it formulated. And then, this is another beautiful story, but Alejandro was out doing a ceremony on some place on the earth that he felt was greatly endangered by some energies. And that evening, we don't know how exactly it happened, but whether there was some effect of this, because that's a whole story in itself, but Alejandro suddenly had a heart attack and died.
Oh, my.
His son was with him. And it was very, very tragic to all of us who loved him so very much.
Oh, yes.
And a great loss for me. I always thought that I would be somebody who would be studying indigenous medicine, but it never turned out that way. It only turned out that I would have the opportunity to to hear about projects and needs, and that I would become a bridge.
Yes.
Some way that I could to help the people. So that was true for me. I really never got to study with Alejandro.
Mm-hmm.
But because of my association with Modesto Chalco and Pro Naturaleza, and also my association with another nonprofit here in the San Jose area, Tropical Rainforest Coalition, we were able to continue on in some work that had been started and stopped in the Manu Basin, which we called, again using that more westernized word, Shamans Confederation Project. And through funding with Modesto Chalco and his organization, I and all the others working together were able to organize 11 indigenous communities that are in the perimeter of that zone, and to go by boat to gather, to bring all the people and their families to have a big confederation conference. And in that conference, it was to be a time where something that wasn't usually done would now be done. And that is that usually when you seek a teacher worldwide, you go as an individual and you almost have to qualify to receive those teachings.
Mm-hmm.
But all of these medicine people agreed, these community leaders agreed, that now is the time to organize all the teachings and to share them freely and influence each other, because the teachings would be lost if they didn't do this.
Oh.
So in that beautiful time we had, this is all on the Living Bridges webpage if people want to look at some of the pictures and read about it. We also had, there was a local health center, and we invited the Western Peruvian physicians to come and participate in our ceremonies and in this dialogue. And then all of the medicine people went to the local health center and also did a ceremony for that center. So it was another way of joining the more westernized medicine with the traditional medicine.
This is just remarkable what you've been able to, be involved in and support, Donna. So wonderful.
It's wonderful to know, and I can't tell all this, but each of these things bridge to other things that I can't really talk about. But I will say, because people know about endangered languages and the dying of certain cultures, the Huachipayri, I think there are only really something like 50 official members now of that community that Don Alejandro grew up in. And so with his son, we were able to do some projects, again, on the Living Bridges webpage to preserve. I don't even know some of these people are still living. The older women, teaching to the young people their ways of making pottery, their ways of weaving the fishing nets, the traditional plant medicine. They had many, for the young people. It was sort of like summer camp. So those were all sponsored, in the Huachipayri community. And so it was a wonderful era there. And medicinal plant garden, we sponsored that for another man, Don Alberto, who lived in the area, who also became a teacher in Cusco and went on to do many projects with other foundations. So some of that work's still going on, and I won't talk today about the destruction of the Manu area, the perimeter zone, but needless to say, if we get at the end perhaps today to talk about the voices of those shamans, then I can overlap that a little bit.
Sure.
So I'm going to tell you this last part, because at the same time, every time when I worked, I would be in Cusco, and I had many friends there that were growing friendships over those years that I was visiting. And so one day I was sitting in a van with one of my friends who had brought one of his friends, Claudio Quispe, from a traditional Andean community called the Queros. Now, I had no knowledge of the Queros at all. I did not know that there is a foundation in the Bay Area, which is now worldwide. It started, I think, in Los Angeles. I'm not quite sure. Miami, the Four Winds Foundation with Alberto Villodo. And he was one of the, I think he's also Cuban and North American descent. he had been studying with the medicine teachers in that area and had actually already brought some of them to the United States for giving teachings. But I didn't know any of this then. So as I sat in the van with Claudio Quispe, he started telling me about his community and about the needs of the community for a school and how there were so many children that were sick and dying. He didn't know why. Maybe it was the water, he said. So when my friend Richard Aguayo got back in the van, I said, you know, I never heard about this. Do you know about this? And he told me that, yes, he had created a safe haven in his home, in his patio and home for the Queros as they came down to Cusco to actually, you know, live there when they came down so they'd have a place to live, and they had become activists. So I said, well, maybe, you know, maybe there's something we can do to help. Let's talk more. So we talked with Claudia Moore about the needs of the community, and that's where we left it. One night, some months after I got home, there was a fax. I had a fax machine. I don't even think I had email still. There was a fax that came for me in the night, and it had official stamps on it and beautiful signatures. And it was from the Queros community, and it basically said in a very official format, we agree to have all your help. And I hadn't asked. I hadn't said I would. So my first response was to have, you know, an adrenaline reaction because I thought, how am I, what am I going to do? How am I going to bring help? But I won't tell you the whole story. Not too long after that, another friend of mine who had a foundation met me in a coffee shop. She saw me in a coffee shop one day right after that. And as she was getting to leaving, she said to me, by the way, I would like to give some work to your foundation, because it wasn't a nonprofit then, but to your foundation, which was already called Living Bridges. And so she said, I would like to give you $5,000. So that was the seed money. And again, it was quite amazing. So it came just at that time. So to make a long story short, keeping with our model of being invited in, that money only went to bring some people up, an anthropologist, people that lived in Cusco and knew the Queros, had been to the communities before, that these people were all researched, and they came with us to the communities. And we did an investigation in 11 communities of what the needs were and had meetings in all those communities. And so it was there we found that, of course, as many communities were affected by Giardia in the water, that at least a large portion of infant mortality was due to the large, you know, the Giardia, the parasite protozoa in the water. And so we, over those years, I'm shortening it, we developed a three-part project in which we would have water systems for the community, we would have greenhouses for the community to help build an infrastructure. This has to do with the global warming, but that also we would build a school, a traditional school, because they didn't really have a school, and the one they had was some 3,000 feet lower than most of the communities and only taught Spanish, not Quechua. So this was the Muñetica school, the Flowering Earth School that we built, and there were some $100,000 or more of funding that was raised, and if we ever did a special talk on this, some listeners may know the Queros, it is quite a story of these people are the last real descendants. They speak the Royal Quechua language. And so just as the Lacandones were related to the original Mayas, the Queros are related to the original Incas. And so many, many people came to learn their ways. And their last great spiritual leader, whom I was able to meet 2 years before, he died in his home high in the Andes. It was about 17,000 feet there where he lived. Don Manuel Quispe. Yes, he did say then, a man of just great light and love, but he sadly said that he wasn't going to pass on all of his teachings either. So many stories there, Sharon, but that is...
Yes.
That's what brought me... Living Bridges became a 501c3 through the need to obtain grants.
Yes, yes.
What an honor, though, Donna, for you to have gone down there and then to have made all the connections and for them to send their facts to you. You know, we accept your help. I mean, what a bridge that is. You truly are what your organization is all about, a living bridge.
Well, thank you, Sharon. And so now you see how many voices and how many people are involved. This is just a little tiny story of that. But
so much for listening.
And
for the so much to take. Yeah, we're going to take a 5-minute break right now. Do you think this would be a good time to do
it? I think it's a perfect time. Thank you, Sharon.
Okay, excellent. I just want you to share before we go to that break. We'll take a musical break, and then Donna will be back for the second hour. What is your website again? Any websites you'd like to share? Any contact information?
Yes.
And anything that, you know, the people can do to donate, because you're in the process of continuing this as you leave tomorrow on an airplane for South America.
That's right. 2:30 in the morning, I'll be on the road to get there.
Amazing.
So my webpage, but it's our webpage for Living Bridges, is your usual www.livingbridgesfoundation.org. I was heartened to know there are many, many foundations out there actually called Living Bridge or Living Bridges. No, there are many bridges out there, but ours is livingbridgesfoundation.org. And in our links, you'll see other links, including Tiangong International Foundation, Tropical Rainforest Coalition, and links also to a young man I will talk about whom I work with, who is a bridge and a link, Jonathan Weissenberger Miller of OSA Foundation. So to the listeners who might be leaving the program, for our next hour talking some about the reforesting of the Kacha Mountains, I'm going down there specifically to help raise money for the next phase of this reforestation project. And we do need any donation. We're hoping to raise $15,000 for our next step to build, again, waterways from our water catches into the communities so people will have water for their gardens.
Oh. Just wonderful work that you are doing. If people do want to donate, do they go to Living Bridges Foundation?
They can, and there's your usual. I think it's something different right now that we're using, not PayPal, but it's one of the ones that people are familiar with.
Okay, very good.
Thank
well,
you
Donna,
asking.
This is just an honor, and I'll be delighted to be with you for the next hour, or however long it takes to share your story. And we'll take a musical break right now. What I'm going to be playing is I'm Declaring Peace. It's a beautiful piece by William Florian. And if you want to just be still and have a little meditation during the time, you can. It's a gorgeous song. And we'll be back in about 5.5 minutes. I'll let people know that this is The Voice of Change. I'm Sharon Ann Wyckoff, and today I am interviewing Donna Runnels, and she is a licensed psychotherapist in private practice, and we're talking to her as the executive director of Living Bridges Foundation and all the work that she is doing to help the people in the South Americas. We'll be returning in just a moment. Enjoy, William Florian, I'm Declaring Peace.
If war was the answer, then we'd be at peace. And the battles in the distance would have all finally ceased. We'd still have a choice to live and be free. So let's all raise our voice and become a planet of peace. I'm declaring peace. I'm declaring peace. Deep within myself, I'm declaring. I'm declaring peace. I'm declaring peace deep within myself. I'm declaring peace. I'm declaring peace. I'm declaring peace. I'm declaring peace. Deep within myself, I'm declaring peace. I'm declaring peace. I'm declaring peace. I'm declaring peace. Deep within myself, I'm declaring peace. I'm declaring peace. Declaring peace, I'm declaring peace. Deep within myself, I'm declaring peace. I'm declaring peace. Declaring peace, I'm declaring peace. Deep within myself, I'm declaring peace. I'm declaring peace. Declaring peace, I'm declaring peace. Deep within myself, I'm declaring peace. I'm declaring peace. I'm declaring peace.
Welcome back to the Voice of Change. I'm Sharon Ann Wyckoff, and today I am talking with Donna Ronalds, and she is talking about the reforestation, and the name of the program is Reforestation, People Making a Difference One at a Time. And she certainly has made a difference in all the work that she has done here as well as in the South Americas. And we are going to learn more about her project that she is involved in down there now. She leaves tomorrow morning, and I'm just so honored, Donna, that you were able to do this program before you leave. Thank you.
thank you so much, Sharon, for again for giving a voice at, from the earth and for on behalf of the trees to this project.
Yes.
And I'm so happy to be able to talk about it.
So glad you are. And you mentioned when we were talking prior to the program that this is the Year of the Tree, did you say, from the United Nations?
Yes. I did not know this during the entire year, but I know it now, that 2011 was declared by the UN Council on the Environment as it's actually the International Year of the Forest.
Mm.
And if people, you know, want to put that in their browser and search, they'll find that you can also, as I did, listen in to some of the ministers, the ministers of the interior of many countries, sometimes they have a different title, to see what many countries are saying about the forest.
Oh.
And it's very interesting. So
I can imagine.
So it's timely that we're thinking about forests. And I, you know, maybe on that note, I was so fortunate just to attend the first day of the Bioneers Conference, the Bioneers. You know about it, Sharon, I'm sure. Any listener and people in the Bay Area know Bioneers is held usually at the Marin Civic Center, has been for the last 22 years. It's been, you know, alive and well and growing. And this year, the very first speaker of the plenary talks, they have speakers that give the initial addresses every day on major important subjects. Bioneers is Bioneers, not Pioneers, Bioneers for a Sustainable Future. And our first speaker was John Liu this year, Chinese original filmmaker, journalist, and so forth. John spoke about the project of the Les Plateau. I don't remember which province of China, but it gave the same view of hundreds of years ago how this, through unsustainable practices, the plateau became an actual desert. It looked like a moonscape when we saw the original pictures of it. But over time-lapse photography of 15 years with an interaction of the people and also even the Chinese government supporting the project, it has become a verdant land of green with the rivers flowing in their right tracks again.
Oh, how wonderful.
And it was so heartening to see that. So it gave me a sense that whether or not Bioneers was really knowing that this has been, you know, in some way worldwide declared as the International Year of the Forest, that the voice of the forest was coming up to be number one.
Yes, yes.
So that, you know, that's an inspiration for reforestation. Do you think would be helpful to say something about, you know, reforestation in general and what it means, Sharon?
Please, please.
Okay. So one thing people, I wasn't either really knowledgeable that, just to say this part, that, you know, places that I thought of, because I'd been there, the high Andes, maybe at a little bit higher level, but I really wasn't aware that a lot of the dust that I saw, a lot of, I just thought it was because it was above tree level, but I didn't have an awareness of how much deforesting had gone on there. And that not only climate change, but the loss of people and their communities there because there's no way to sort of eke out a sustainable living is one of the major causes of people living, you know, leaving their traditional way. So we have a great need for reforesting also in many of those high mountain regions. So reforestation itself, of course, is based on, I mean, it's one of its importance, and it's from a scientific standpoint, it, depending on, you know, however much biomass is there, it sequesters the carbon dioxide from the carbon, you could say, from the atmosphere. So the trees and the plants, when they are there, they actually absorb and conserve all this carbon. And I think I was looking, I think it is 3.7 billion tons of carbon per year in the amount of plants we have now, you know, the forests worldwide are taken from the air. And, you know, this helps to stop the global warming. So you can imagine the reverse. As the forests are decimated, we have less and less of that biomass. And the human beings also... You know, we are native of carbon ourselves, because just like all other living things, we are made of carbon as well. So it's all part of one whole. And the other part of, we've already said this, but the other part of this in the Andes, I'm going to talk about Patricio, the young man who's in charge of this project. The other part of this is, besides in his region, which has experienced also volcanic eruption in the last 6 years, a lot of ash, which has degraded the soil further, and so forth, the acid alkalinity base of the soil. Mm-hmm. But for their area to be able to restore the topsoil when, you know, much erosion happens when there is rain, and mm-hmm. also just, you know, I call them the three Bs, the bees, the birds, and the beauty that we have.
Oh, the bees, trees. The birds, and the beauty.
The three Bs.
Yes.
Which all, you know, we know what trees do for our heart and soul and spirit.
Yes.
So there's all of that part of reforesting. And people can just look up. Now we can get information at our fingertips more about the need for reforesting.
Mm-hmm.
So with Patricio, there's another young man. I just want to tell you about him for any listener. His name is Jonathan Miller, and he will be giving a talk Wednesday, November 2nd. This is also on his webpage. I can give that at the end, on rainforest conservation and the indigenous perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be at the United Earth Networks at the Craneway Center in Richmond, California. And I can just say his webpage at the end, because for many years, I don't even remember how I met Jonathan, but I believe I found him by looking on the World Wide Web, and that he was working again back to Ecuador. This is in the last 7 or 8 years. I found the work of Jonathan. He had been working in Ecuador because he lived there from the time he was 18.
Mm.
And he was working to help getting to know the people there down in the, they call it, of course, the cloud forest, but also the eyebrow region of the Andes that it goes down into the forest floor with the Amazonga community. And around, you know, the Amazonga community is situated. It's a community that migrated there, people that migrated some generations back. They're Quechua speaking. They are in the center of a forest, the Sangay Forest, one of the largest preserves of rainforest in Ecuador. And, of course, this rainforest was starting to be, primary forest was starting to be impacted again by colonists coming down and trying to find, you know, have a living and cut it down. So Jonathan, who's all about sustainability, he's an ethnobotanist. He knows the forest from the inside out and also the voice of the people. He carries all this. He had as one of the projects in his heart to help get the land, to buy up the land, which, you know, the people no longer own, of course, to buy up this land and to preserve the forest. So that's how I got to know Jonathan. And the synchronicities of life is that Jonathan, having been very successful and very determined in his efforts, also was able, with his grants and his work over time, to purchase a plot of rainforest on the Osa Peninsula of Costa Rica. And for people who may know the Osa Peninsula, it's also one of the last great places of beautiful primary rainforest in Costa Rica. He now has a center there, and people can visit it.
And he's just a young man himself, isn't he?
Yes, he informed me, I think of him as very, very young, but he informed me that he just turned 40. So he's been working quite a while.
I think we saw him once, yes.
Yes, you have met him, Sharon.
Uh-huh.
No, he doesn't look
my.
That. He's got the vitality of the earth for sure.
Yes,
so
yes.
Jonathan had this Osa forest, and my work had also taken me over these last years to be involved with Tiangong International Foundation. And so Dasa Latian, the founder of Tiangong, often takes what he calls cultivation journeys on the earth to investigate mystical places or to get information about certain places on the earth. So he asked me one day, do you know anything about Caño Island in Costa Rica? And I said, well, no, I've never heard of Caño Island. And he said, well, do you happen to know anybody? Because often he would ask me these kinds of things. Do you know anybody there? I said, no. And I said, but I know somebody that knows about Costa Rica. So I called Jonathan up, and he said, well, Caño Island, well, that's directly in front of my retreat center.
How interesting.
So for people who want to look this up, something I learned about the mystical spheres of this Osa Peninsula is an amazing wonder of the earth. These giant spheres, which have perfect engineering, there are many, many sizes. Some are 6 feet high. They're spheres, and they are not constructed in any method that we know of in this era of history. So it's a very mystical subject. And Dasha Letian, Grandmaster Letian, and Master Tianying had also wanted to study this. So I and another, I had gone with them to Costa Rica for some other work, and then we joined another woman from Tiangong, Mary Ho, in this journey to visit Jonathan Center and the mystical spheres. And while we were there one evening, I was going to go out to the beach, and it was very dark. And Jonathan caught me on the way down the trail and said, "Where are you going?" I'm saying, "To the beach." And he said, "No, I want you accompanied to the beach." So he said, "I'm going to send Juan Patricio down with you." And I had never met, we call him Pato, is his nickname. I had never met Pato. And so as we sat down on one of the logs that had washed up on the shore there under the starlight that night, Pato Patricio spoke with the most eloquent and heartful enthusiasm about his dream. And he didn't know anything about me. I was just a visitor there, really. He didn't know anything that I had done work, so I know this is another synchronicity.
What a beautiful synchronicity.
Yes, and just in that, I don't know how long we were there. Maybe it was an hour, I don't know. But he had been working for 10 years with his dream that he could reforest the area. And really sort of atypical as a young man in his community. He had not married as yet. He'd really devoted himself to the community and to his family, and he was almost 30 years old then, working with the young people. And there's a lineage here in his family. But anyway, I knew we had just received some money in Living Bridges, and we try to turn that money around as fast as we can when we get it. So I knew when I was walking up the beach, I just said, "Maybe I can help you, Patricio." So when we went back and talked to Jonathan, he said, "Well, oh, yeah, so I know all about, that's why Patricio's here, because he wants to earn some money and also learn how I do things to go back to community." So one thing led to another. We had breakfast with Dasa Letian and Master Tianying, and they were just also so impressed with Patricio. And later in my talks with them, they also thought that the International Foundation of Tiangong is very interested in sustainability, would also be able to give some money. So, Patricio,
another synchronicity.
Yeah, it was another synchronicity, Sharon. So we were able to get the money for Patricio to purchase the land to build a greenhouse, to have his own land for the greenhouse, which he did right away, got together, you know, of course, with help from the community. And to also begin, Jonathan helped with the second stage of getting money for the water catch. And you can look on the webpage of Living Bridges, livingbridgesfoundation.org, and see a nice little PowerPoint, beautiful little slideshow of the work so far. So I won't detail it, but it has been in 3 years. And in this period of time, Jonathan tells me the reforestation had actually begun some, but all told, there are about 100,000 trees that have now been planted.
Oh,
and you can
my.
See them growing. And the nursery holds 40,000 trees at a time. And one of the most beautiful things I saw, this is on the webpage, you can see the members of the Ecuadorian Army, both men and women, in there, in their uniforms, and they're all carrying trees. They're riding in water trucks. And, of course, the government sent in their country with no war going on their soldiers in a peacekeeping mission to help replant the earth. So
they're involved with the project also.
They are. They're involved in that way, and hopefully there will be more help in the future. So I want to mention one thing because the listeners would be touched by this, too, I think. When someone is a visionary, as Patricio is, even though they might have help in their family, which he does, I think he has something like 8 or 9, well, I'm going to tell you the story, he had more, 8 or 9 brothers and sisters. Mm. When you're a visionary, oftentimes all over the earth, you don't have support right away, which is only normal, because you're on one end of what we used to call the bell curve. You know, you're in that one, you know, maybe 10 percentile, sometimes a 1 percentile, and you have a vision. And people have done things the way they have. They also don't trust things from the outside, which they have reason. That's a whole story, too, not to trust. And also, you know, maybe to think we can get started in something, but, yeah, where's going to be the money to keep it going?
Yes.
Which is a realistic concern for people. So Patricio had some support for this project, but there was still some skepticism. And so as it was turning out and the first water catches had been built and filled, there was not yet a fencing around the first water catch, which was to be built. And in that area where there aren't big reserves of water or ponds or anything, the children don't have swimming lessons, as you can imagine. Mm. So in the most unbelievable tragedy, almost 2 years ago now, when Patricio's family came home one day from their fields, two of his little sisters had drowned in the water catch.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, it was almost unbelievable. And
oh,
for the people
goodness.
Who knew them, of course, Patricio's whole family, Jonathan, another man I'll be working with starting, you know, in a couple of days, Bruce Harlow from California, who's a friend of the family, and other people who had been helping, everyone was devastated. So if anything would have put a big dent into this, it would have been what you might call the bad omen and the terrible tragedy of this. But the family, having the fortitude that people have, and I want to tell you a little bit of the history of that Andes in this way, they rose up from this tragedy. And
yeah.
Actually, Pato's feeling is, and I think his family, that, you know, they apparently, these little girls were very special girls, and there were some 200 people that came to the memorial. They were very special children. And people spoke about what kind of heart these little girls had.
Mm.
And so they feel that the spirit of the children, you know, is there now in the trees.
Oh, how beautiful.
It's a very beautiful inspiration to keep going. So I want to mention the lineage of this area, because I didn't tell you this when I spoke of the Caras, but it's the same issue that some people don't know of. There were great land barons in the Andes who came. I talked about in the last hour about the giardia from the non-traditional grazing animals that were brought in, the cattle and sheep, into the area. So over these decades, the Queros in Peru, the community I spoke of, and also Patricio's family from generations back, in these decades of the 30s and 40s and 50s, the people were made indentured servants for these land barons. And there are many sad stories here that I'm not going to tell of how terrible those times were for the people. And there was someone of great heart, actually was an anthropologist in the case of the Queros, and his son still works, one Nunez del Prado, who's still living. His father was the one who helped the Queros, and he's now teaching the Inca medicine as a more traditional but Cuscanian teacher and professor for the Queros. But in Patricio's area, it was actually a, Jonathan told me this story, it was actually a Monsignor who took up the plight and the voice of the people, appealing to the government to help the people have the opportunity to, if you can imagine this, buy back their own land.
Oh, my.
Yes. So apparently the people in Pato's lineage and in that community were very frugal for years, sometimes having only one meal a day, and very, very frugal with their resources. They buried their coins in earthen jars and saved up till they had enough money to buy back their land. And I would wonder if all of us would, you know, would yet have faced, you know, these kind of sacrifices that they made.
Yes, exactly.
And they did it together as a community.
Yes.
But nevertheless, I think it's 1972 that they were granted the right to do this and get their lands back and have ownership. Mm-hmm. And they still have what they might call an Independence Day celebration in that area every year to mark that date. So, Patricio's grandfather was part of this. And even you won't recognize it because there's not a lot of text on the webpage, what his grandfather did on a very, very small plot. And this inspired Patricio in this vision of reforesting, is he got a small piece of land and planted all the native plants as they were together and let the biodiversity mature so that Pato could go sit there as a young man and just dream in that space.
Oh, how beautiful.
Very, very special.
Oh,
So shall I tell you what is needed in that project at this point?
Is this the project you're going to be involved in now,
and so,
when you go back to there tomorrow?
Yes, it is. And I was...
Oh, yes.
I was just moved by Patricio's name for the project, because, of course, you know it's a community project. It's for his community. I'm going to tell you, he's in the Chimborazo province of Ecuador, Agua Santo community, Central Highlands, in the Cacha Mountain area, K-A-T-C-H-A. And again, second language is Spanish. He's a Quechua, of Quechua-speaking people. And so in this area, the project is in the Agua Santa community, but there are many outlying communities that you spoke of in the introduction that need this reforesting. So it really would look like a 20-year project.
Yes.
If you look worldwide, just put in the word reforestation in your browser, you will be heartened to see, as we all are, there are hundreds of grassroots foundations all over the world doing reforestation. And
wonderful.
Yes, it is. Patricio, being a visionary and a cross-cultural being, he would love to go to China. I can't wait to have him learn more about
this. Oh, my goodness.
He would like to study there. He would like to visit other projects so he can learn from them. And I would love to bridge him together and to help in that. So we'll, you know, we'll think something about that.
Yes.
So that's Patricio. He called it, this is what I was going to tell you, in Quechua, it means dressing the mountains in green.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
It's very beautiful. And we need that to inspire us. This is truly the feminine. So for the project now that we are working, when I go down there, I will meet with Bruce Harlow, who's coming from Oregon to meet me. He's a longtime friend of the family, always goes and donates his time. He works in the forest here in Oregon. His favorite home for part of the year is called Happy Camp. So you can imagine what type of a person Bruce is.
Yes.
And Jonathan will join us later in November when he comes to Ecuador for other work that he's doing also. And we're going to have meetings with the community, go to other communities, and we're looking at how we can write grants as we return to help refill the nursery again. So we're going to have to repurchase the soil bags where the seedlings, they get their start in a soil bag. Bruce is going to teach us an ancient method called seed balls, where you put many kind of native seeds together, and then we're going to be able to give these seed balls to many communities while we're there so they can get started on
how wonderful.
Yeah, it's just going to be beautiful. They also need some skilled labor help. All of the work was done by participation of the community, building all the water catch and so forth, and in, you know, community work called Minga work. But we need skilled labor. We need to be able to rent a tractor. And this would have to do with rebuilding the Inca terraces that were destroyed during the time of those large plantations and the overgrazing. But they are, you can see them there, even in the picture. So they need to be rebuilt to help with the erosion. And then another dream is to build a very, very humble and simple ecotourism center on the very top of the mountain near the community.
Oh,
and that would be an astronomical center. There are sacred sites near there, view the stars, and also an outlet for their beautiful woven goods. All the communities have those, and also just so people could come and be a volunteer in the project and come home and, you know, share with other people about what's going on.
Oh, my.
So those are the dreams, and I want to tell you about the one dream that I have, too. I heard that Patricio was very proud because he has a high school education, but he has no college education. And lately, as he goes around giving his eloquent talks, it's a lot of people from different disciplines. I noticed when I work on project, they are engineers, but they're all called engineers if you have a specialty. So lately, people, without knowing his background, are calling him engineer.
Oh, my.
He's very proud of that because he knows it means that they recognize that he's gaining knowledge, and he would love to attend college and learn more about
it. Oh, how special.
He is very special. So, of course, as a mom, in some ways to him also, we are planning to take a trip to the local university right near in Riobamba, down from his home, and find out what it would entail for him to go to school and get his degree while he's still working on the project.
Oh, that would be so wonderful.
Wouldn't it be wonderful, Sharon? So I dream of getting
Donna.
That, especially. So that's Dressing the Mountains in Green. Can you see and hear about all the bridges that are going to go on?
Oh, yes, for sure.
One.
Oh, my goodness. So where do you fly into in Peru tomorrow?
So tomorrow I fly into Quito. And
okay.
Then I will have actually more than a day to rest, which I'm glad because it takes me a little bit of adjustment, not as long
yes.
as it used to, and
yes.
that's another story, but it takes me a little longer maybe to get to the 11,000-foot adjustment, and then we'll be going to about 14,000 feet probably Monday, Tuesday, I'm not sure which day. And then we'll actually, I hear, they've prepared a place for us to stay right up in the village. And so we will not have electricity up there, and I will, I told you I was kidding you last
no
night.
No electricity?
Yes, I was kidding you because as I was thinking I was going to pack last night or maybe prepare some notes for our talk, suddenly there was
yes.
not a bang, but just a blackout in my home.
Oh, my.
And went outside. I was the only house that had a blackout.
Your house was the only one.
It was the only one.
Electricity.
Yeah, it was the only
oh,
one.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah,
the universe was preparing you.
I think it was. So I remembered that in Peru's community, often just to conserve our supplies for the whole community house at night and even to cook all the dinner if there would be 30 or 40 people in the community stone building, we had one candle. So I knew that one candle watt can give a lot of light. So I,
yes.
I knew it was an omen of some kind. But anyway,
it was.
So I'm
Donna.
Honored that I will get to stay there in the community, and I hope to be a much better voice for the project.
You are such a voice, my dear, and I would love to continue having your story shared in the Voice of Change. I don't know if you have Skyping down there in any way that we can get some of the people, because I would love to share it. And maybe we can even do something, to earn funds up here, because I think you are doing amazing work.
Well, thank you, Sharon. It's just thrilling to be able to, I haven't for so long had a chance to talk about this work. Probably it's been 5 years because I've been also doing other things. And
yes.
It's so important to be able, just for me, it just lifts my heart to be able to share about it. And so you're inspiring me by giving me this opportunity to share. So
it's a delight to have you. You, I'm sure, are such an inspiration to so many people down there, and up here too, people who know your story. So I would love to continue to be that voice. We have 30 minutes left. How do you want to best use your time?
Well, there were a couple topics that you, in your wonderful way of giving us prior thought about a program, we brought up together a couple of topics, and one of them that we brought up, which I'm partly qualified to speak about, not fully qualified, but partly qualified to speak about.
I think you have a great ability to speak on any topic related to this.
Well, this one is called Yin Sustainability, and that's a topic that we had talked about. And and then we talked about something that many people speak on, and this is the rise of the feminine and the feminine values. This would be the rise of the feminine in all people, all genders, the rise of the feminine in general as a balancing point.
Right, let's do that. So why don't we start with the yin sustainability, and maybe you can kind of redefine that, and then we can go into the feminine. I've done many shows on the feminine.
Oh, Sharon, I bet you have.
So, yes.
So maybe in that way what I could do is go back to the voice of the forest from the medicine people, from the maestros.
Yes.
We could just link it a little bit uniquely because, yes, there
Please.
Are, I hope there are more and more people speaking on that subject.
So
tell me this. You have been honored, and we have been honored, to hear your radio programs with our Master Tianjia. I know you did one last night.
Yes,
our Tiangong master right here in Berkeley, California, and I know she also, in one program, spoke some about yin sustainability not too long ago. So I don't know if you think, should I say just a tiny bit? Would it be helpful to say something about Qigong and Tiangong?
If
what
you'd like,
you
certainly.
Well, if there's, if you know, just for reference, many people
certainly.
In the Bay Area know Qigong, but Qi basically means energy, and Gong means many things. There are many meanings of Gong, but one applying to this would be the work of or the workings of, the way of the Qi.
Yes.
And so the practice of Qigong, which is an ancient heritage from China, but all over the earth there are energy practices, of course we know this, but from China, the Qigong practice has given way to many schools of Qigong for cultivating the energy of the earth. Cultivating means to grow, to strengthen, to get in better relationship to energy. And that's
mm-hmm.
a big topic. So that's basically Qigong. And Tiangong is one of those schools of Qigong in China. And one interesting fact is before the founder of Tiangong left China in 1995 to teach worldwide at the third International World Qigong Conference, they named, of the thousands of Qigong, they named some couple thousand, they named 12 top Qigongs. And on the top of that list, they placed Tiangong.
Mm,
and that was
that
basically,
honor.
I know, it's a great honor, but well-deserved because it was based on the great effectiveness and the strong energy field of Tiangong, the great effectiveness in bringing about healing in the practitioners of this particular Qigong.
Mm-hmm.
So this, now we come to the topic of yin sustainability because that term, as far as I know so far, was actually coined by Grandmaster Dasa Litian, founder of Tiangong, and I first heard him mention it in a beautiful talk he gave at the Earth Dance Conference. He was invited to be one of the cross-cultural elders there. I think it's been about 4 years ago, and you can probably go still on their site and find out, you know, in the back history of this talk. And there are some of them, some of Dasha's addresses also posted on the Tiangong.org webpage.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave a beautiful talk there about yin sustainability. And so in keeping with our talk about Qigong and about the words from China, yin and yang, it's, the yin and yang is actually very familiar to all of us in our third dimensional. This is the third dimension, so I'm told we're in the third dimension, the dimension of duality, day and night,
mm-hmm.
Hot and cold, male and female, we have duality everywhere. So the yin refers to one side of the duality, and the yang refers to the other. And to really explain this, I learned from my physics friends, there's no one true answer to explain the mystery of the universe, but we use models to help us, you know, have a way of relating to what is the universe made of. And in this model, when we look at modern science, which is all over the world, of course also in China, modern science, we have in modern physics the particles and the waves. And so
mm-hmm.
we know that the particle nature is everything that we can put our hands on, the sensory thing. For the human, it would be your blood, your bones, your body. And the yin part would be everything that's part of life that you cannot see, or the invisible part. And that would be the qi. It would also be things like spirit, personality, temperament, soul. All those things are part
yeah.
of the yin nature. And for school children, when we show them a leaf that's live and then a leaf that's all dried up, and we say, what's the difference? And they look at that, and we say, well, this one has qi. This live leaf has energy, and this
yes.
one no longer has qi. So
mm-hmm.
we can still see it's a leaf. It looks like a leaf, but without the qi, it doesn't have the same life. So it's the same for all of us, that our energy, our life, that's the basis of our life, is this life energy or the invisible animating qi of life. And it's kind of said that all life comes out of this mysterious invisible qi. Many implications for health. But now we're going to go into the yin sustainability and back to Dasha's Earth Dance Conference. So one meaning of sustainability is also, you know, we think of survival at this point. You know, how can we sustain something or sustain ourselves? But also in ecology, sustainability really comes to refer to having biodiversity, having all the diversity, all the voices represented is what sustains us. And so, you know, we look at sustainability, we look at what's endangering or what's hampering it. And so from a young side, as Dasha was up there addressing the people, he began to talk about sustainability, and he said, how many people know, he explained yin and yang, and he said, how many people know what the greatest cause of now what I'm calling yang pollution is on the planet? So that would refer to things that we could actually touch as particles.
Right.
You know, get in touch with, I think we understand that. So many people raised their hands, and the first one gave the right answer. They said, carbon pollution. And he said, yes, that's right. But now that I've explained yin sustainability, he began to explain it. He said, I wonder if people would care to answer the question, what is the greatest cause of yin pollution on the earth? And I think was just so taken by this question that I don't even remember what people said, but the ones he called on, of this 500 and so people, no one got the right answer, and I certainly didn't have it. But I want to say something just to make it more understandable. Years ago when I was working in the Andes, in the Quechua community, the Queros, the medicine people told me that there's an energy that human beings give off that they've never seen around other plants and animals. And they called it hucha. And they said this energy is a dirty energy and it needs to be cleansed, and that they had energy methods that were traditional, going all the way back to the Incas, to try to cleanse this energy from the energy field of human beings.
Oh, my.
And so Dasha began to speak, and so this is his answer. It's a little more complicated, and I'm going to explain a couple more ABCs. But he surprised everyone by saying the answer to the greatest yin pollution on the earth is thought pollution, negative thinking. And now this is not a surprise if we read a lot of magazines now and we're saying, you know, your negative thoughts, because I'm working in the field of psychology too, so we're getting way more on the positive side now, what brings about health, not just what illness is.
Yes.
But he began to talk to us as a real spiritual master, of course, would, to dialogue with the audience about the effects of how powerful our thoughts are and that they actually create a toxin when we have them, and that accumulates. This is one of the causes of yin insustainability, is the yin residue, the actual energetic residue of our negative thoughts and feelings. Now,
amazing.
This is a topic for psychology because we can't help all of these things that happen. We can't help all of our feelings, but that's a broad topic, and there are many wonderful answers and support for how to heal this. But that's basically what he said. Now, here's the other part that has to do with the earth. He went on, and he gave another beautiful talk later about this, about yin sustainability, to use the model. In Western times, a man by the name of James Lovelock, some years back, put forth the Gaia hypothesis, the Gaia theory, that the earth, this is a Westerner, the earth is a living being. And, of course, this view has always been held by indigenous people and all through the ages. But he did a great service by talking more about this, to bring this forward. And then the School of Deep Ecology with Arnie Ness and the other people I mentioned, first hour, John C., Joanna Macy, the voices of deep ecology, what the inner meaning of ecology, the yin meaning. So in any case, he spoke about the earth and the human as a microcosm, the earth, our mother, as the macrocosm, and saying that just as you see the meridian charts, if you go to acupuncture, maybe people have seen these rivers of energy that are pictured that run through the human being, that by the same token, the earth also has energy meridians. And if the human being becomes ill, the yin causes are the cloggage and stagnation of these energy channels. And right now on the earth, the clogging and the damage to these energy channels on the earth as a living being, from the digging, from the reforesting, from the mining, from everything we can think about, has disrupted the energy channels of the earth. So he made an appeal to us to understand, once again, our deep relationship to we are the earth.
Yes.
Healing ourselves is healing the earth. And so that's the beginning concept of yin sustainability. Mm-hmm. And Sharon, if I might talk a little bit more about that, about Tiangong, just
yes,
to say
certainly.
That, thank you, because I know you're a great supporter of Tiangong
yes.
as well,
yes.
and you also practice these methods.
Mm-hmm.
The Tiangong, the masters also, in their cultivation journeys that I spoke of earlier, go to many places on the earth because part of their work is to help clear the yin pollution, help resolve some of this pollution. And they call themselves, through the universal work, universal janitors.
Oh.
And they tell us that we're all janitors as we clean
yes.
and help cleaning. So they do this work of all the time of going in their own ceremonies and their own travels to help the earth. And just so I might say this, the second half of my journey this time, this is another project of Living Bridges, and also to support this project, I will be going with a team of people, including Master Tian Ying, who is a Tiangong master from Berlin, and she will be meeting us in Peru, and we will also be going around to teach in the forest and the people Tiangong practices.
Oh,
and
that's what you're doing this time. That
the
is
second,
wonderful.
The second half will be that. And
oh, beautiful.
Within Tiangong, thank you, Sharon, within Tiangong we have many practices to help, just as these other energy practices, many unique practices actually to
yeah.
help sustain our energy fields, to help cleanse our energy field. And for me, which is a whole other program, this is how I found Tiangong, because I also became very ill. And that, may I tell you, Sharon, how that overlaps with psychology
please.
A little bit?
Please.
Okay. So as I want to say this in case there were ever a psychotherapist listening, and something I try to educate other friends of mine in the field, and one day this will be more known, that through my work in psychotherapy over many years as a therapist, you're always joining energies with your clients. And
mm-hmm.
you're helping heal emotions, and you're helping, you know, bring out people's feelings to help resolve their sadness, their anger, all their other feelings.
Yes.
And so as an energy being, you're also absorbing, just like other health practitioners like massage therapists and, you know, energy healers, you're also
mm-hmm.
absorbing many of the yin toxins of
yes.
the other person. And I didn't know this. I had no way to clean my energy. I didn't know about this problem at all. And actually, the medicine teachers in the Amazon had recognized this and were trying many times to do ceremonies for me because of what they called attached energies. And
oh, my.
Yes, this is also linking, bridging over to Tiangong, but just to make
certainly.
A long story short, that's how I met Dasila Tian just before 2000. And he had asked me to help him start his nonprofit foundation because he had known that I had started one. He needed help with the paperwork and, you know, how to do all these things. And so
uh-huh.
later on one day, I told him I was going to my acupuncturist and I had to leave our meeting early. And he said, why didn't you tell me that you needed more help? And so
oh,
he
my.
Investigated more, and I, you know, from his encouragement, I was already doing a lot of things. I became involved in learning Tiangong, and
mm-hmm.
I am, Dasha once said to me, I said, well, what should I do? There's so many things that I want to work with and help with, and he smiled, and his answer was, he said, always help those things which are helping you the most. So
oh, how interesting.
I knew that was Tiangong also. So that's how I became interested in becoming a teacher, just naturally evolved to sharing the practice of Tiangong, which helps us heal and support our energy fields and become yin sustainable.
Yes.
So that's that story in a nutshell.
Oh,
there's much
that's
more to
beautiful.
It.
That's beautiful. Mm. Oh, Donna, this has been just such an amazing time, and we have a whole 7 minutes left. Actually, five or six.
Okay.
you know, I don't know how you want to use that, but please, this has just been a beautiful, beautiful flow of energy and ideas. So appreciate it. So what would you like to share as, you
well,
know, you conclude this two-hour special?
I think I want to go back to the voices from the forest, and also because our leading edge that I left off with is Tiangong, and there's so much to say, and we have our wonderful Master Tianjia right here in the Bay Area, and also her program with you that are going to continue to bring forth the what you might call yin technology of Tiangong, and I will I will always echo whatever part I can, and as time goes on, there will be more bridges there. But going back with our idea of the feminine, when I met Alejandro, and I'm watching my clock, but years ago when he, that same visit, when I first met him in 1994, I had a private meeting with him, and across his mesa cloth, his beautiful woven cloth with all his sacred objects, when I told him that I wanted to make a bridge, he got up and was doing almost a little dance. And he said he was very apologetic. He never wanted to offend anybody up here. And he, in this little dance he was doing to show me, he took out his hands and held them in front, and he said, "See this right hand?" He said, "This is the Father." And he said, "I'm so sorry to ask you this, but will you please, all of you here, please put the Father now behind you." And he put his right hand behind him, and then he said, "This hand is the Mother. And will you please bring her voice to
what a wonderful story."
And so it was, you know, it was a beautiful thing to say, which I didn't fully understand then. So there are two things. When I interviewed at the Shaman's convention, this has a little bit of a sad note, the Confederation meetings. Alejandro's teacher, who's no longer living, who is quite an elderly man then, he took over as his father when Alejandro's own father died. And I printed out today a couple of things that he said from that interview. May I read that, Sharon?
Please.
So he said, I asked them, what would they like to be the message to the people back in the cities, at least, you know, in North America? And he had a very big heart. This was all said with great heartfulness. And he said, "We do not want too many people from the city. We hope that they stay in the city. We would like the forest to stay as they are without being hurt. I always listen to the messages of the forest, and they ask me to take care of them." I think this means the earth herself. She says, "Take care of me. Please don't kill me. Please don't punch your machetes in my soil." I think this means everything, the bulldozers, everything. "Please don't punch your machetes in my soil because you wound me. Do not cut me in this rough way. We have to take care of the forest." And then at this point, he put his hand over his heart, and as he spoke, I know we both cried together. He said that the voice of the forest wakes him up every night. And he said, "Few people can hear the messages from the forest which come to me at night. First, you hear a sound that is very different, like a moan. The sound wakes me up, and then I hear the message. Other messages come in my dream. The plants appear as real people, but with a more pure skin. This is the way the plants come and ask, 'Do not be too rough.' Medicine men should be very alert and listen to the messages from these plants. Those spirits come from everywhere, from the sky, from the depths of the forest. We gather the spirits, and when we cure, it is from them. Sometimes I feel very sad with the messages because I suffer them in my own body, what the forests are suffering. It is good to be in good communication with the earth. We need to ask her to forgive us for having hurt her. When the forests talk to us in this way, they will give us energy." So that was his voice to us. And in just the last moment, I want to say that Alejandro's vision, and he had made me the godmother of this center, so I feel this story I want to say at the last, the story of Wanami, which is the Wachapairi word for tree of life. And this was a cross-cultural story of this time on the earth that we're in, the time of Maya prophecy, time of Hopa prophecy, time of the wrinkle in time, which is the rainbow bridge prophecy of the Inca, that we're in. And at this time, the Wanami myth is that a woman of great purity would arise, and she would take all beings in her arms and nurture them. And I can't help but feeling, and I want to say that I know this great woman is rising in all of us.
Yes.
And so that's the meaning also for me of becoming a living bridge, that we become a bridge from the earth, from our heart, and into the universe to bring the great voice now and to give back to the earth, to Pachamama, what she gives to us.
So beautifully said. So beautifully said. You know, as you share this, I always try and give listeners something that they can do easily and effortlessly. The four phrases. Do you think that might be something to just mention?
Yes, would you mention it, please, Sharon? I'd love to hear you
say about it. We have learned this through Tea and Gong, and it is the work of Dr. Liu, who healed many people. Anything you think of that you are wanting to heal, you can just say, I love you, I'm so sorry, please forgive me, and thank you. And Donna, you have just shared so much, and my heart is just filled with such gratitude for you on this earth, being such a living voice for the forest, for making such a difference. You are a person making a difference. And so are the people that you know in the South Americas. And as you travel down there tomorrow, I just send you such love and such gratitude. Let's give your website one more time so people can go there and learn more about what you're doing, as well as if they want to donate to your 501c3 foundation.
Sharon, thank you so much. I want to make sure that I thank you for what you're doing, because
you've given
me the most amazing opportunity to be a voice for all these wonderful people and places. And so if people want to read more, the website is livingbridgesfoundation.org, and there are other links to the projects and also to the other foundations, some of which I mentioned, including Tiangong International Foundation. So my love to you, Sharon, and to any listeners out there, and
my
to inspire
love
to you to start whatever you feel to begin, because that's the way
it
goes.
Yes, it is so important, and you certainly are that voice to inspire so many. Thank you again so much, Donna. This has been an honor, and blessings as you go forward to continue your work in the South Americas.
Thank you so much, Sharon.
Thank you.
Sending you love.
Sending you love, too. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Donna Ronalds, and you can reach her at livingbridgesfoundation.org. Amazing, amazing woman. I want to let you know that we just have a few more programs upcoming. The next one scheduled is November 11th. It's with Johanna Z, and the title is Motherhood as a Means to Mindfulness. And then on November 25th, I have Kurt Abraham returning with me, and he will be doing a program, Understanding the Seven Rays of Energy, that is based on his last book. Know that all of our programs are archived at the Voice of Change, which is at blogtalkradio.com/voiceofchange. Thank you so much for listening today, and we will see you next time on the Voice of Change. Please know that today is the first day of the rest of your life. I invite you to live it consciously with love and gratitude. As we go out, we have just a moment. I'm going to play Jeffrey John White Bear's World, Creating a World. Enjoy.
I've lived on this land called America. My parents taught me how to be a good patriot. 45 years I've lived on this sacred land. I learned the language, learned the way. learn some fun of the history too. What I wasn't told as I was growing up was all the cause for me to be here. Well, I'm not saying I need to lay any blame. I'm not saying I need to feel any guilt. Right here and now, I'd like to proclaim, we are creating a world where our people are loved. We are creating a world no longer run by fear. We are creating a world where our beings are held with the sacredness of a newborn child. Hearing about the slave